on today's show.
If worship really is an encounter with God, that we should expect it to be as emotionally rich and as experientially present to us as any other personal interaction I might have with someone. The origins of contemporary worship in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, and its various stages of evolution was always trying to recapture, oh yeah, at its baseline, when I come and I worship with people, I'm encountering the power and presence of the living God. I think that's what the charismatic and Pentecostal traditions, that's what the central thing that they have to give to all the other traditions of Christianity, is that worship is encounter. The reality that, oh, it is supposed to be an experience that's personal, and that personal experience should affect all of me. And that does include not only my mind, but my emotions, even though it has its own hangups and things for people in our traditions to critique. The gift it is to remind us it's not less than that.
Stay tuned. Greetings and welcome to the Missions Podcast, the show that explores your hard questions on missions, theology, and practice to help goers think and thinkers go. I'm Alex Kochman, Director of Communications and Engagement with ABWE, joined as always by Scott Dunford, pastor of Western Hills Church in San Mateo, California. And we are joined by a special guest whom we'll introduce in just a moment. But first, if you are one of our subscribers who's been blessed by this show, but maybe you've never left a positive review and a five-star rating, we're not telling you that you have to, but we are saying that you must and you ought to. And we're not begging, but look, we know that there's 10 to 12,000 of you, and not that many reviews. And in all actuality, we're grateful for those of you who have left us notes in the reviews, but that helps other people discover this content. And really, Scott, the reason that we do this show is not exclusively because you and I enjoy nerding out over theology and missiology and occasionally debating things cultural. Although that's a big piece of it, I'm not going to lie. That is a big piece of it. But it is because we want to move people out into action and into the world and outside just the safe, comfortable confines of, you know, the ivory towers, right? I mean, that's what this comes back down to. That's how we started the show in 2017 with that vision of not just helping people to think, helping them go, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You could even summarize it by saying helping goers think, and then for the thinkers to get them to go. So
what? That's good. That's gold, Jerry. Gold. Somebody write, Brian, write that down. That is pure gold. Enough filibustering, though. We should get into our topic here for the day. Of course, if you've clicked on this, you already know what we're discussing, maybe even with whom we're discussing it. But just off the bat, Scott, one of the things that brings us together in all the conversations that we have is we're both approaching all the topics of missions and evangelism. We're approaching them as churchmen, and both of us serving in different capacities, but, you know, both in smallish churches and both trying to do, you know, similar things as far as returning people to scripture and giving them an appreciation for tradition in some level, whatever that looks like in each context. Music, though, we know is one of the most controversial things in missions, on the mission field, at home in the States. It's what churches split over. We all remember the worship wars. Scott, what does a typical musical Sunday look like at Western Hills Church?
Oh, thanks for putting me on the spot.
You're welcome. You
know, I mean, when I have musicians in the congregation, I'm just happy, period. You know, I mean, when you're dealing with a little church, you know, I mean, we get excited when we have 55 on Sunday. So for a lot of you, you can't imagine church that small. I mean, in where I grew up in Michigan, a lot of small churches had 100 people. We're dealing with what we've got. And we're thankful we have live music instead of canned music. And then it's a matter of like just over time, like preaching the word, teaching the word, and then starting to like develop a taste for music that is richer. And it's because, you know, the truth is most people, like their exposure to Christian music is either what they learned from their grandparents singing out of the hymnal in country church, or whatever they're listening on K-Love or Smile FM or whatever the local Christian station is. And oftentimes that just isn't isn't very rich and sometimes even theologically pretty bad. So,
yeah.
As a small church, it is a constant something of prayer and work of trying to like, hey, how do we cultivate deep and meaningful worship for people? Because for some people, in fact, probably for most, what they're getting out of the music is probably going to be more memorable to them than what they got out of the sermon.
Well, and in reality, I feel this as a worship leader in our church. I have access to the mic more than our pastor does. In all reality, the musical worship is doing as much, if not more, to shape people than the sermon often is. And I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. Although maybe we'll get into that very thing with our guest, but it is an incredibly influential position. And look, we talk about recruiting missionaries, church planters, pastors, theological trainers. We don't always talk about the role of a worship leader or a worship pastor on the mission field and in churches in the U.S. Engaged in frontline mission in some way. And so with that, I'm pleased to introduce our guest, Zach Hicks. Zach is pastor at Church of the Cross, which he planted not that long ago, right? Zach, how long you said correct. You're
about
into this?
A year and a half ago.
A year and a half, yeah. Along with Doug Webster and Jess Leslie, in the summer of 2022, you guys planted. And you're also the author of Before We Gather, which although I've not read it, comes recommended by Brian Van Timmeren, our producer here. And so, Zach, it's great to meet you. Fill in some of the details here. Tell us about your background, your family.
Yeah, I grew up in Hawaii, studied music in Los Angeles, lived in Denver for 10 years, lived in Fort Lauderdale, Florida for 3, and then finally landed in Birmingham, where I've been for 8 years. I've got 4 kids. And they're all kind of older teenagers now. One of them's in college. I've served in a few different kind of contexts of big church, small church, some Baptist churches. I'm ordained as a Presbyterian minister and served outside of that context for longer than I've been inside, as strange as that sounds. I've seen a lot of different cultural contexts within the United States, and all the while until this current role have been serving as a worship leader. So sat in the seat of the chief musician in a pastoral framework. So I was a pastor of the church, led music on Sundays, planned worship services, oversaw the teams of people that helped plan and lead those services, and then did classical pastoral things like preaching and teaching and visiting people in hospitals. And now just find myself fully in the seat of this new missionary call to reach people falling through the cracks of cultural Christianity in the American South in Birmingham, Alabama, and having the time of my life. I'm enjoying not being a music leader for the first time and working with Jess, who is, and she's an incredible, incredible leader and thinker. So it's been great.
You know, speaking of hogging the mic and me having too much of it, Scott, I'm actually, you know, I'll defer to the pastor here. Scott, why don't you go ahead and lead us off, take us into our conversation?
Yeah. You know, I think in our circles, at least Alex and mine, kind of where we come out of, like, there's such an emphasis on the word, and we don't want that to not be the case. Of course, like, we think, and especially where expository preaching and unpacking the text of scripture. And so much energy and effort is being put on how the sermon impacts our listeners. And yet, if I'm honest, you know, and I don't think I'm a bad preacher, but I realize that worship is affecting probably our listeners every bit as much, probably more so than what I'm preaching on a typical Sunday. And yet, you know, and so then we're sending out people to the mission field, we're engaged in ministry. So the question is, you know, I realize this is very basic, but just lay the groundwork for us. Why is worship so important for ministry? And then as we are sending missionaries out, why is worship so important, not just for the cultivation of their own hearts and souls? And please address that. But as they're going out and planting churches, why is having a robust theology and practice of worship so crucial as they begin that important task?
Yeah, I'm going to start with maybe what can sound like a possibly controversial statement that comes to us from the discipline of what's called liturgical theology. Don't be concerned about that title. But there's something of a mantra that comes out of that that discipline of study. And the mantra is this, that worship constitutes the church. Mm. In other words, if Christians aren't gathering and worshiping, they aren't really being the church, and there is no church. Mm. That's a challenging statement to those of us from context who view kind of conversion as the end goal in what makes a Christian. And the kind of maybe the view of the church that's being looked through that liturgical theology lens is that Christians aren't just sort of saved and go to heaven. They're saved into a community of faith, a body of believers. But that body of believers really can't be identified as a body until they're doing the things that that body is called to do, and that body is called to worship.
And to jump in real quick too, you don't mean exclusively musical worship by that either. We should say that at the outset.
We might even go back and say the sermon is in fact a kind of experience of worship as well. And we've sort of downgraded what worship means when we sort of use the language of we're gonna have a time of worship over here, and then there'll be the sermon. And that's one of the things that we need to lift our heads about in relation to when the church gathers and walks through a series of rituals. And I use that word positively, because whether you're charismatic and spontaneous, you have a set of rituals, or whether you're more liturgical and scripted, you have a set of rituals. Just humans are, sociologists remind us that we're ritual producing creatures by nature, and we make rituals to make meaning. And God has prescribed all kinds of rituals to be a part of what the church does when the church comes to worship him with everything that we are. So when the gathered community comes to enact these rituals before the Lord, that's what identifies us as the body of Christ. It's what identifies us as the church. We can talk later about its relationship, its inseparable relationship to mission, but that's kind of the link there, is that if Christians aren't worshiping together, they aren't being the church. That's what I think that's what the scriptures lead us to the conclusion of.
I couldn't agree with that more. And that's critical in the whole discussion over missions. If we're planting churches, what is it that we're planting? We're exactly. planting not just scattered groups. I mean, this goes back to our old conversations, Scott, about insider movements, about CPM, about DMM. We're not just planting scattered masses of converts or of those we suspect to be converted. We are working to form visible churches, local churches that are assembled in a way where you can look and you can say, yes, that's a distinct community of people gathered to worship this God, in this case, the triune God. Zach, what would you say, where did we lose that story? What you're saying is, I think, biblical, and certainly older generations understood that. Where do you see the contemporary evangelical church lost that narrative? Was it with the seeker movement? Was it before that? And what do you blame?
Yeah, I think it was before that. I think there's a lot of factors that play into why we're in the state that we're in. A lot can be pointed back in Western Christianity to the Second Great Awakening, particularly, because the Great Awakenings were the first time where we really saw these massive waves in the recent past in the West, these massive waves of converts disassociated with big language, ecclesiastical bodies, disassociated with local churches, where the emphasis was on someone coming to faith, but not necessarily how that brought them into the life and discipleship and worship of a local church and community. And so the seeker movement is recapitulating some of the things that happened in the Second Great Awakening. A lot of good research has been done to sort of show that people might think of the seeker movement as a relatively recent thing, but it's just a modern iteration of the same values that were a part of the pragmatism and the win the lost at any cost mindset. But once you start having, for instance, evangelistic rallies that take place outside of church contexts in the frontiers and in tent gatherings and elsewhere, one of the things you lose is a sense of how this spiritual experience, which I believe really did change people and the gospel was really there and the Spirit was producing fruit, how those spiritual experiences translated into what people do when they gather and are the church as a worshiping community.
Well, let me ask this of you as well. And I agree with that. I think we should add, and you qualified yourself at the end there too, we're not against the preaching of the gospel. We're not against the need to do evangelism. Obviously outside church walls is where it often needs to be done the most. I think you're right. It's doing these things in a way that's disconnected from the ordinary discipleship of the local church. Even if you look at something like the Great Commission, right, Scott? And, you know, you have, okay, make disciples of all nations, teaching them to obey, baptizing them. You know, baptism, teaching, those are things that really imply and don't really happen outside of an established local church context. That's right. Where those ordinary means of grace, those ways that God is at work among his people, that's where they're happening each and every week. And so with that, I do want to ask you, Zach, what do you see happening right now within the contemporary church that's maybe not so negative? Is there anything that you see modern evangelicalism as getting right at the present time with respect to musical worship?
Yeah, this might sound like a surprise for someone who's theologically oriented, intellectually oriented, and believes in the life of the mind and values careful critical reflection. But one of the things that the contemporary movement has given back to the church is the engagement of emotion and the centering of experience of God in a worship service. I don't view that as bad, and I don't view that even as competing with the things I mentioned, the life of the mind and theology. And I think that if worship really is at its core an encounter with God, and that God is, you know, three persons, God is personal, that we should expect it to be as emotionally rich and as experientially present to us as any other personal interaction I might have with someone. And I do think that the origins of contemporary worship in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s and its various stages of evolution was always trying to recapture or become reacquainted with, oh yeah, at its baseline, when I come and I worship with people, I'm encountering the power and presence of the living God. I think that's what the charismatic and Pentecostal traditions, that's what the central thing that they have to give to all the other traditions of Christianity, is that worship is encounter. You know, those of us in other traditions have other things to add to that dialogue, but the reality that, oh, it is supposed to be an experience that's personal, and that personal experience should affect all of me. And that does include not only my mind, but my emotions. And so all the feelings, all the experiential nature of a lot of contemporary worship, even though it has its own hangups and things for people in our traditions to critique, the gift it is to remind us it's not less than that. And sometimes in our circles, we tend to view that as the problem and vilify it. And contemporary worship always seems to be still emerging as something vital that people have forgotten, that people are drawn to because of something primal and central about us as emotional and affective beings, that we really do need a personal, living, emotional, intellectual, whole selfed encounter with the living God.
I love that.
Scott, I want to hear from you next and let you ask a question. But, you know, first, I just have to get this in. As we're thinking about the emotion, I am reminded of how much I've benefited from the Puritans. The Puritans, contrary to their name, the bad press, understood that deeply. You read men like John Owen, you read men like Jeremiah Burroughs, and there is a deep sense of the significance of the affections in our walk with the Lord. But maybe you, listener, are someone who has attempted to read the Puritans but doesn't know where to begin. And that's why we want to let you know about the Missions Podcast's new relationship with Reformation Heritage Books. And in our ministry partnership, we want to let you know specifically about their Puritan Treasures for Today series. Mine is on the way in the mail, and you'll see it here in the studio once we have it set up. But this whole set of books makes the works of these classic writers, again, men like Owens and Burroughs accessible for modern readers, which I think is just so vitally important. And as a way of saying thanks, and as a part of this partnership with ABWE, Reformation Heritage Books is providing a special discount code. And so if you go to learn more at heritagebooks.org/puritantreasures, you can use the promo code MissionsPod. That's all one word, all caps, MissionsPod. When you order, you'll get an exclusive discount code on that series and anything else that you would order from them. And so we're thankful to them and their partnership with us as well. But Scott, I'll turn it over to you. There's lots more to uncover here. We also haven't really even talked yet about what this looks like cross-culturally.
Well, yeah, first of all, let me just say about these updated Puritan works. I'm excited about that. If anyone who's tried to like dive into John Owen, the old
not easy
version, you're like, oh, please update it. This is fantastic. Same thing is true with Pilgrim's Progress. I mean, I've read Pilgrim's Progress so many times in the old, you know, original John Bunyan language. But to get a fresh version, I want to say translation, because it's almost a translation. What a blessing. So anyway, I'm excited about that. Let's talk a little bit about the hymns movement. I realize in some ways, you know, some of the passion you had for that has been successful and that it's just become such a huge part of today. But, you know, honestly, even recently, even in my own congregation, we were struggling with something with music. When I first got here, we didn't have any musicians, and there was the musician that we were going to have didn't show up. And I said, you know, let's just sing some a cappella hymns. And they all looked like me. I had two heads. And I'm like, well, how about, you know, like there's a fountain filled with blood, John, you know, like no one had ever heard of it before. And this is a congregation of people mostly in their 60s and 70s who did not know those songs. So let's talk about that for a second. How does connecting generations, and granted, you know, like I'm in the Bay Area, most of my people didn't grow up in the American or Western church tradition, so that makes a lot of them English as their second language, so that's part of the issue. But how does connecting generations through shared musical texts build our faith? And so why has this been an important part of an emphasis of you in your writing and even thinking in the past of trying to take some of these older texts and help them connect to our emotions and sensibilities and feelings today?
Yeah, you're right to say that we are at a different cultural moment now than we were when I was participating in and writing about this, quote, hymns movement that was going on. But even back then, there was a general sense in which, given all that had happened in the wake of the contemporary worship movement and the seeker worship movement, we were emerging in the early 2000s in a time when a first generation of Christians who might have grown up in those kinds of churches would have received a lot of messaging that was all about now, God doing things now, worship songs from now. Whether they knew it or not, they were just participating in pure contemporaneity, pure nowness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No exposure to the traditions of the past, because those traditions are dead, and those traditions were lifeless, and the Spirit is moving now, and we need to pay attention to that movement. And that kind of subtle but persistent messaging meant that there was a whole generation, decades worth of Christians growing up without an awareness of what the Apostles' Creed calls the communion of the saints, an awareness of how when I'm part of a local church, I am part of a body of Christ that transcends the people I see in this room, and even transcends all the other bodies of Christ that are all over the world in this current moment, that really I'm participating in followers of Jesus who have been following Jesus, listening to his word, responding to his word, putting their faith in Christ for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. Once you get that perspective about your identity within that communion of saints, within that body, all of a sudden you're opened up to a world of wisdom of the way previous Christians have read the scriptures and have applied them to the life and worship of the church. And once you zoom specifically into the singing of the church, you realize that, oh my goodness, I have access to far more worship songs than the CCLI top 100 charts, far more worship songs than have been given to me by the past 10 years of worship songwriters and MP3s and streaming services. And so once you sort of have that brain, and then you go to a place like the Psalms and you start looking at, oh, wait, the Bible has its own collection of worship songs here. And then I start comparing those worship songs to the songs that we have now. All of a sudden you're exposed to gaps. And that was the revelation of those who kind of experienced this treasure trove of forgotten hymns for the first time, was like, there are all these worship songs out there that sing things that I've never sung before to God. And I want to sing them because I find them true. I find them identifying things about me that I've never said openly before God before. So I'm finding myself tapped into this idea that maybe I should confess my sin to God. Maybe I should lament to God. All these things that the Psalms have always been teaching us, but our narrow bandwidth of the last 20 years of worship songs may have been a little bit anemic in. And so that hymns movement was an attempt to say, we love and appreciate the modern musical idiom of the present day, but we find the content a little bit lacking. We love the content of these old hymns, but maybe find that musical idiom a little challenging for us now. So why don't we put those things together, grab these old hymns kind of like poems without music, and reset them, reimagine them in modern musical ways. And that spurred on and spawned a bunch of different recordings from a bunch of different regions of the United States and the UK and even Australia, for people doing what we called retuning hymns and rewriting them, sometimes changing the language a little bit, because most of those hymns are old enough where they're in the public domain and the songwriter's dead. They're not going to come after us, even though Charles Wesley said, don't ever rewrite any of my hymns because I'm the best. That's kind of what he said, sort of.
And it was really good. Yeah.
It's good to know that the intellectual property challenges have been around always, even before CCLI.
They have. Except he had no recourse. So he just used his ecclesiastical authority to say, don't do it or else God will hate you because these are pure perfection. You know, that was kind of the idea.
And the money and the intellectual property, that's a whole other discussion.
So I'm not a musician, but I've had multiple guys who play guitar say, the problem is most of our modern worship is driven by guitar and I don't know how to play these hymns. They're really hard. And you guys both play guitar and you both lead worship. Like, I mean, I guess I don't know for sure, Zach, if you play guitar. I assumed you did.
I do.
I mean, if you're watching on video and you see his hair, like if Zach's not a guitarist, then I'm just an imposter.
I thought Alex should be an
organist, but he's a guitar player too.
There's a musicological answer to why hymns and guitar led music don't really intuitively go together, and you have to actually work at it as a musician to rearrange it. And it's because hymns are kind of from the idiom of the classical Western tradition, which is what's called block chord formation, change chord every syllable, every beat. Guitars don't work like that. They don't, at least in modern rock idiom, which doesn't actually come from the Western classical tradition. It comes from Africa and comes from jazz and comes from the roots outside that normal way of doing things in the Western. So they have different musical origins, which means that when they arrive at a point of trying to be together, they find their languages at odds. It's like, oh, I don't use the same musical dictionary you do. Guitars typically will want to move over a single chord for several syllables before changing that chord. And so the trick for the guitarist is, how do I rearrange this hymn that changes chords every beat to something that's far more open, that's much more like a folk style or a rock style. And unless you're musically trained, if you're just sort of a guitar player that's used to reading chords and then you are faced with this four-part hymn, you're challenged in being able to make that transition well.
That's obviously true, and I would agree with that. I would also just say we're blessed by so many artists and resources, many of them on the open web, that can help people find arrangements that can be done. People have done the work of simplifying some of the arrangements as well. That's one piece of the equation. The other piece of the equation is I have a lot of respect for churches that have led their people through the process of, hey, we're going to do a monthly psalm sing, or we're going to do a monthly hymn sing, and we're actually going to teach you how to sing in parts. One friend of ours actually serving with Every Ethne in the ABWE missionary family, They are of the habit of gathering the men at the piano before the service, maybe half an hour, 20 minutes before the service, teaching them the songs, if they're unfamiliar, so that they can not only sing robustly and set that example for their families during the service, but then they can use those same psalms and hymns during family worship throughout the week. So I also think that we part of it is because we've consumerized worship. We've sort of said it, what we do on a Sunday morning has to be the simplest and most intuitive. And we do have to meet people where they're at to a certain extent, but there's also places where we need to bring them into the life of the church, which means a comfort level with music, right? So similar to the way in which missionaries traditionally, historically would teach literacy before they can really teach scripture. There are certain, you know, musical literacies that the people of God should and need to cultivate in order to engage in worship in that way. I just want to make one other comment too. I think there's a lot of reasons that we should familiarize ourselves with these older traditions, these old paths. One of them is the connection to the communion of saints, Zach, like you mentioned. But I think the other is this, and maybe this is a little bit more of an individualist dimension, but I've often joked with congregants when we've spoken about song choice that to me, it has to pass, a song has to pass the deathbed test. It's not a hard and fast rule, but it's sort of like if you're reaching the end of your life, if you're lying sick on your deathbed, or if you're surrounded by family and all you can do is sing this song a cappella through a season of suffering, does the song hold up, right? Do those 150 repetitions of some simplistic phrase, does it hold up at that point? Or is that the moment when you're singing, you know, Rock of Ages? Or is that the moment when you're singing the doxology or the Gloria Patri? I mean, there's
so many. Drop me Jesus through the goalposts of life.
It's true though that we want these songs to be useful when they're not accompanied by all the accoutrements of the modern instrumentation, when you're walking alone, when you're in prayer, when you're on your sickbed. Those are moments when those songs need to be accessible to you as well, right? And so I think instrumental music can't be the crutch that prevents us from benefiting. But maybe, Scott, do you want to key up a question about what this looks like in other cultural contexts? That's the only piece where we haven't really gotten into that here. And I think, again, we need to circle back and underscore the fact this is not just an American church concern. This is the global church's concern, because music is a part of the gathered body life of churches everywhere.
So just the other day, you know, one of my good friends and my brother went on a trip to Cameroon,
West
Africa.
He's your brother, but he's more of a friend to you. Is that what I'm gathering?
No, my friend and my brother both went. So,
I read
my friend who's like a brother and my brother who's also my friend together. These two guys, these two pastors, went to Cameroon, and you know, they're always sending me pictures. And one of the most beautiful things was listening to the gathered Cameroonian church. They were doing a pastors' conference there, and all these pastors and the church there singing together. And I want to say they were singing like "How Great Thou Art," and so it was beautiful because I was watching, you know, my brother and my friend sing in English, and these guys and some of the Cameroonians speak English, and then a whole bunch of them speaking and singing in French or in their dialects, and it was beautiful because there's a shared moment. But there's also, you know, some pushback sometimes in the missiological world of like, should we just be importing our culture, our thoughts, our music, our worship into these other cultures? So the question is this. What do you recommend us doing in places that, especially like Cameroon has a history of Christian life, but some places where missionaries are serving, they're planting the first church that's been in existence in maybe generations in that area. There's not a Christian heritage in that language. You know, we have good friends that planted churches in Papua New Guinea where they had no concept of the gospel until it was brought to them. And they're learning and singing songs for the first time to our Savior. So what are the benefits in your mind of exposing them to the history of hymnody, you know, particularly our Western hymnody? And then follow up to that would be like, how would you encourage missionaries to help new churches in other cultures develop and create their own hymnotic traditions? So I don't know if you've even thought about that before, but you know, we're the Missions Podcast, so we've got to think about that. How would you address that question?
I thought about that a lot. All music is contextual. All music comes from a time and place and culture. the idea that the church possesses something ethereal and eternal and is not from a cultural time and place, I believe is a myth. Mm. So the awareness of that means that if we're bringing music from some place that's not part of a culture, just helping the church be aware this isn't the idioms of this music isn't native to our culture. It isn't better. It isn't worse. In previous iterations of mission work and churches going from one culture to another, there has been the mistake, I think, of privileging and prioritizing Western culture as superior to whatever culture it was being done. And it wasn't even conscious. It was just, hey, this is the way Christians worship, period. So you Right. need to not only be a Christian, you need to be Western. And thankfully, you know, we're that water under that bridge, that's kind of there. So I'm not someone who says, oh, therefore all the music needs to be native to that culture. But I would hope that part of the missionary's job over time is not only exposing people who are indigenous to a certain population to the wider church's history and way of praising God, both musically and textually. I think that's important. And the benefit of that is that you could be a small church and the only church in a country or in amongst a people group, and yet realize, oh, wow, I am part of a huge body, which is a great encouragement to small and beleaguered groups of Christians. So that's the benefit. But I'd also encourage missionaries that if it's within your grasp, part of your job is to be a bit of an ethnomusicologist. Part of your job is to ask the questions, how would these people in this time and place naturally express praise and joy and lament and all the hues of the Psalms unto God in their own idiom? Just like we as missionaries in an unreached people group would go and study a language, I think you want to study all the emotional and cultural and aesthetic languages as well. And the importance of that is the perennial missionary question of how much of this culture can we move toward and contextualize? How much is it co-opted amongst ungodly or pagan ideas or practices? And I think that's for every missionary to solve on the ground locally, you know, but nevertheless, it's that careful, prayerful work of discerning and then translating. So my hope for long-term for a missionary is that they'd be identifying artists and converted musicians amongst the population or others who could help them in creating this body of local material, even as they're utilizing the material that is available from the great tradition of Christ's church, so that the local people can have a sense of their identity as a worshiping community. And it's both and. It's I'm a part of something much bigger than myself in my time and place, and I'm part of what the Spirit is doing in our time and place. And God values it, and it is sacred and beautiful and holy.
Love it. Mm.
Well put. And that might be one of the first times I've ever heard someone use the word ethnomusicologist in a way that wasn't sarcastic. Ha. You know, what the college major that's always like, what is this even for? Well, now we know what the appropriate use of that term and discipline is.
Yeah, that's right.
But in all seriousness, if we're going to think about taking the gospel to the nations, Christians are a singing people.
Yeah.
This is a hot take, and usually we keep all the hot takes behind the paywall. But my hot take for this episode is this: I think every pastor, ad missionary too, should be able to lead a hymn sing a cappella. Don't have to be great at it. Don't have to enjoy it. Well, you should have to enjoy it a little bit, but because it's a ministry of the word, this is not a part of the Christian life that's just for the experts and for the trained. This is a part of prayer. A part of prayer is not just speaking to God. It's also speaking poetically and singing to God individually and together. It's psalms, hymns, spiritual songs. It's not optional. And what a joy and a privilege that we have. You know, other religions, other traditions that they don't have this. Maybe they have it in glimpses and types and shadows, but in all reality, among the world religions, Christianity is unique. We're a singing people, and it's because we have something worth singing about. Zach, how can people get a hold of your book, your past writings on this, and maybe learn more about anything that you're currently up to?
Yeah, best way is just all the usual sources of buying books, Amazon, that's fine. So yeah, go there, check that out. I don't publish or write on my website anymore. It's just there statically to be around. And other than that, I'm pretty underground right now. So I continue writing, continue producing music, but largely I'm here for my local church doing my local thing and enjoying it.
Well, we appreciate you joining us here. And for our premium subscribers, stick around, go to the premium portal, and you can get your hands on the new Overtime episode that we're going to record together as soon as we finish this conversation. And that is, Scott and I are going to relitigate the worship wars. Not really, but maybe. Let's get into really what is that line between conviction and preference in worship? Because, you know, we've had a lot of common ground here in this conversation, but truly nothing is a bigger lightning rod in church planting than music itself, even sometimes more than the preaching. And so we need to get into all of that. Should everyone be using a traditional liturgy? We're going to get into all those questions. Again, if you're not a premium subscriber, though, what are you waiting for? If you would prayerfully consider partnering with this ministry at $9.99 a month, you'll get access not only to our library of bonus features, but you'll also get access to our community thread on Signal. You'll get a free gift for joining, and you will also receive access to our regular webinars, our live streams that we do throughout the year, where we involve you in the conversation. In fact, we've got one coming up here very soon, Scott, and looking forward to actually bringing our subscribers onto that feed so that they can converse with us in real time. Lots of exciting stuff. If you want to join a community of other people that are working through issues of rich theology and missiology together for the nations, then join the family at missionspodcast.com/premium. For the rest of you, we'll see you on our main episode in the main feed next week. Until then, go make disciples of all the nations.